This COE is based on the New York State appellate decisions dealing with negligence-related issues that were released in May of 2020, and the summaries of those decisions were posted in May 2020 on the New York Appellate Digest website. The summaries have since been collected in a pamphlet, the May 2020 Negligence Update pamphlet, and the page references in the COE are to the pages in that pamphlet. The first case is Pariah versus Meisenberg on page 4. It's a case that deals with the effect of failing to include a medical malpractice action as an asset in a bankruptcy filing. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the defendant's motion to dismiss the medical malpractice complaint on judicial estoppel grounds should not have been granted. Vorm Nadirian, that's the person who had the medical malpractice action, commenced the medical malpractice action in 2006. In two bankruptcy proceedings in 2008 and 2016, the medical malpractice action was not listed as an asset by Vorm Nadirian. In 2017, Vorm Nadirian opened the 2008 bankruptcy action, and the medical malpractice action was added as an asset, making the bankruptcy trustee the plaintiff in that action. The Second Department held Vorm Nadirian's initial failure to list the malpractice action as an asset did not subject the bankruptcy trustee, as the plaintiff in the malpractice action, to the judicial estoppel doctrine. The court wrote, "The integrity of the bankruptcy system depends on full and honest disclosure by debtors of all their assets. By failing to list causes of action on bankruptcy schedules of assets, the debtor represents that it has no such claims. Thus, the doctrine of judicial estoppel may bar a party from pursuing claims which were not listed in a previous bankruptcy proceeding. Because the doctrine is primarily concerned with protecting the judicial process, relief is granted only when the risk of inconsistent results with its impact on judicial integrity is certain." Here, the 2008 bankruptcy proceeding was reopened by the bankruptcy court so that the 2006 medical malpractice action could be identified as an asset of the bankruptcy estate. Therefore, judicial estoppel cannot be predicated on Vorm Nadirian's failure to list the action as an asset when she originally filed the 2008 bankruptcy petition. Further, once a bankruptcy proceeding is commenced, all legal or equitable interests of the debtor become part of the bankruptcy estate, including any causes of action. It's citing 11 U.S.C. Section 541. The trustee in bankruptcy, as representative of the estate, has the capacity to sue and be sued. So the bankruptcy court's reopening of the 2008 bankruptcy action to add the medical malpractice case as an asset allowed that case to go forward with the bankruptcy trustee as the plaintiff. Next is Owen versus City of New York on page 5. It's a police shooting case. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the city defendant's motion for summary judgment in this negligence, wrongful death, and civil rights violation action should not have been granted. Plaintiff's decedent, 18 years old, was shot and killed by police after his mother called 911. The court wrote, "A municipal defendant cannot be held liable for negligent acts of its employee police officers where it establishes that the alleged negligent acts involve the exercise of discretionary authority. Discretionary acts involve the exercise of reasoned judgment, which could typically produce different acceptable results, whereas a ministerial act envisions direct adherence to a governing rule or standard with a compulsory result. The defendant submitted the deposition testimony of each of the defendant officers who fired at the decedent, as well as the deposition testimony of non-party civilians, of a non-party civilian who observed the incident. The testimonies of these witnesses demonstrate the existence of tribal issues of fact as to whether the decedent posed a threat of immediate death or serious physical injury to the defendant officers or others sufficient to justify the officer's use of deadly physical force. The city may not rely on the defense of governmental immunity because the defendant officer's actions, if negligent, would be in violation of the patrol guide's prohibition against the use of deadly physical force and therefore not discretionary. With respect to the civil rights violations, the defendants failed to demonstrate the absence of tribal issues of fact as to whether the defendant officer's use of deadly physical force against the decedent was objectively reasonable under the circumstances. The defendants further failed to establish the absence of tribal issues of fact as to whether a reasonable officer facing the same situation could have believed that deadly physical force was necessary to protect himself or herself or others from death or serious physical injury, and that the defendant officers are thus entitled to qualify immunity. So the two causes of action should not have been dismissed because there were questions of fact as to whether qualified immunity was available. Next is Reed versus New York State Electric and Gas Corporation. It's a wrongful death case against the utility and municipalities. There's a statute of limitations issue and issues relating to the appealability of orders relating to motions in limine. Third Department, reversing Supreme Court, held 1. Plaintiff did not allege separate claims for personal injury and wrongful death. Therefore, the 2-year wrongful death statute of limitations, not the 1-year 90-day statute of limitations for negligence, applied to the actions against the municipalities. 2. Motions in limine which limit the scope of the trial are appealable. And 3. Preclusion of plaintiff's expert's testimony based upon deficient disclosure pursuant to CPLR 3101 was an abuse of discretion. The action arose from a gas explosion at the great-grandfather's house which killed plaintiff's 15-month-old son. Plaintiff sued the village, the town, the county, and the New York State Electric and Gas Corporation. With respect to the motions in limine, the Third Department wrote, an order ruling on a motion in limine is generally not appealable as of right or by permission, since an order made in advance of trial which merely determined the admissibility of evidence is an unappealable advisory ruling. However, an order that limits the scope of issues to be tried, affecting the merits of the controversy or the substantial rights of a party, is appealable. As to plaintiff's objection to that part of the order as allowed evidence of the great-grandfather's negligence as a defense to the claim of res ipsa loquitur, does not limit the scope of issues of or impact of a, on a substantial right, therefore such that issue is not appealable. Plaintiff also contends Supreme Court erred in partially granting the New York State Electric and Gas Corporation's motion to preclude the testimony of plaintiff's economist, whose name was Reiber. Finding that the expert disclosure lacked reasonable detail as to how the value that Reiber assigned to plaintiff's lost services and support would be calculated, Supreme Court precluded his testimony with regard to those damages. However, because this ruling restricted plaintiff's ability to prove and recover damages, this issue is appealable. Next is Marks Barcia versus Village of Sleepy Hollow Ambulance Corporation. It's a suit against a municipality relating to a 911 call responded to by an ambulance service, the defendant. The Second Department held the municipal police and ambulance defendants' motion for summary judgment was properly granted in this negligence wrongful death action. Plaintiff's decedent died after his wife called 911 and the police and ambulance personnel were unable to revive him. The Second Department found that the municipal defendants were engaged in a governmental function, and there was no special relationship between the plaintiffs and the municipal defendants. The court wrote, the defendants were engaged in a governmental function as a provider of emergency medical services pursuant to a municipal emergency response 911 system, such that the defendants could not be held liable to the plaintiff unless they owed her a special duty. One way to establish the existence of a special duty is by showing that the defendant assumed a special relationship with the plaintiff beyond the duty that is owed to the public generally. The plaintiff has a heavy burden of establishing the existence of a special relationship by proving all of the following elements. 1. An assumption by the municipality through promises or actions of an affirmative duty to act on behalf of the party who was injured. 2. Knowledge on the part of the municipality's agents that inaction could lead to harm. 3. Some form of direct contact between the municipality's agents and the injured party. And 4. That party's justifiable reliance on the municipality's affirmative undertaking. Of the 4 factors, the justifiable reliance element is critical because it provides the essential causative link between the special duty assumed by the municipality and the alleged injury. There's nothing in the record to suggest that Officer Kelly or any of the defendant's agents lulled the plaintiff into a false sense of security or induced her to forego other avenues to transport her husband to the hospital, and therefore placed the plaintiff in a worse position than she would have been had the defendants never assumed the duty. Next is Cologne versus Martin on page 8. It's a Court of Appeals case, and it deals with a personal injury suit against a municipality and the requirements of the 50H hearing. The Court of Appeals, in a full-fledged opinion by Judge Stein over a concurring opinion, held plaintiffs, the driver and passenger in this traffic accident case, did not have the right to observe each other's testimony at a general municipal law 50H hearing. Both plaintiffs were represented by the same attorney. The action was dismissed because plaintiffs refused to appear for the hearings after plaintiffs' counsel insisted that both plaintiffs be present during the testimony. The Court of Appeals affirmed the dismissal of the action. The court wrote, as General Municipal Law Section 50H makes clear on its face, compliance with a municipality's demand for a Section 50H examination is a condition precedent to commencing an action against that municipality. A claimant's failure to comply with such a demand generally warrants dismissal of the action. Requiring claimants to comply with Section 50H before commencing an action augments the statute's purpose, which is to afford the city an opportunity to early investigate the circumstances surrounding the accident and to explore the merits of the claim, while information is readily available, with a view towards settlement. So the two plaintiffs did not have the right to be present at each other's 50H hearings, and because they refused to attend the 50H hearing, the case was dismissed. Next is Martinez versus Kaz USA on page 9. It's a products liability case, and it involves the attempt by the manufacturer of the product to have a claim against the injured child's parents for negligent supervision. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the third-party complaint brought by the defendant manufacturer and seller of a humidifier against the parents of the injured child, alleging negligent supervision of the child, should have been dismissed. The court wrote, in March 2014, the then 10-month-old infant plaintiff allegedly was injured when she knocked over a humidifier and hot water spilled onto her foot. The infant's father had placed a humidifier on the living room floor before leaving the apartment with the infant's 5-year-old sibling. The infant's mother was in the living room when the accident occurred. There is no legally cognizable cause of action to recover damages for injuries suffered by a minor child against his or her parent for negligent supervision. Additionally, where a secondary right of contribution is dependent upon the parent's alleged failure to perform a duty owing to the plaintiff child, the absence of the primary cause of action defeats the third-party complaint. Although there is an exception when the parent's conduct implicates a duty owed to the public at large, the acts complained of in the third-party complaint were encompassed within the intrafamily immunity for negligent supervision. Next is Lisa I. on page 10. It's a negligent supervision case, and it involves the Rape Shield Law. Third Department upheld Supreme Court's protective order prohibiting plaintiff's child from being questioned about her sexual history. The complaint alleged the child was raped during a sleepover at defendant's home. The complaint alleged several theories of liability, including negligent supervision. Supreme Court held that the Rape Shield Law applied to the civil case. The Third Department held it did not need to reach that issue, holding that the court had the authority to prohibit the testimony to protect the child from embarrassment. The court wrote, "Supreme Court was required to balance plaintiff's concern that the child's sexual history is irrelevant and that questions of this nature are nothing more than a form of intimidation and embarrassment. Against defendant's argument that the child had a motive to fabricate the allegations of the assault because of a purported pregnancy, the record reveals that Supreme Court undertook a balancing of these concerns. We find the plaintiff met her burden of showing annoyance and embarrassment. The child's sexual history, sexual conduct, and pregnancies are not relevant or material to the elements of the causes of action for negligence, battery, intentional infliction of emotional distress, or loss of services. Moreover, it's been determined that there is limited value to testimony concerning the sexual past of a victim of a sexual assault. Instead, it often serves only to harass the victim and confuse the jurors." So again, the Third Department did not reach the question of whether the Rape Shield Law, which usually applies to only criminal matters, can also be applied in a civil matter, but it went on to find that the protective order was properly issued. Next is Zhigue, Z-H-I-G-U-E, versus Lexington Landmark. It's on page 11. It's mainly a procedural case, but it involves res ipsa loquitur. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the judge should not have sua sponte searched the record to grant relief that was not requested in this labor law and negligence action. Plaintiff was injured when a portion of a ceiling fell, causing a scaffold to collapse on him. The judge should not have granted summary judgment on a negligence cause of action which was not included in the motions, and should not have granted summary judgment on a res ipsa loquitur theory. While it is well settled that the Supreme Court has the authority to search the record and grant summary judgment to a non-moving party with respect to an issue that was the subject of a motion before the court, here the court, in effect, searched the record and awarded summary judgment to the movement with respect to an issue that was not the subject of the motion before the court. The doctrine of res ipsa loquitur applies when the injury-causing event, one, is of a kind which ordinarily does not occur in the absence of someone's negligence, two, is caused by an agency or instrumentality within the exclusive control of the defendant, and three, was not due to any voluntary action or contribution on the part of the plaintiff. So the issue here was whether the court could raise the issue of res ipsa loquitur against one of these defendants, and because the plaintiff did not raise that theory against that defendant, the court didn't have the authority to rule on that issue. Next is Merchant versus New York City on page 12, slip and fall case. Second Department reversing Supreme Court held defendant's motion for summary judgment in this slip and fall case should not have been granted. The defendant failed to demonstrate it did not have constructive notice of the water on the floor because it didn't offer any proof of when the area had last been cleaned or inspected. The court wrote, to meet its initial burden on the issue of lack of constructive notice, the defendant must offer some evidence as to when the area in question was last cleaned or inspected relative to the time when plaintiff fell. Here, the defendant failed to meet its initial burden as the movant to affirmatively demonstrate that it did not have constructive notice of the condition that allegedly caused the plaintiff to fall, because the defendant did not proffer any evidence as to when the subject area was last cleaned or inspected. Next is Malloy on page 13, another slip and fall case involving constructive notice. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held defendant did not demonstrate it didn't have constructive notice of the broken curb which allegedly caused plaintiff's slip and fall. The court wrote, the defendants did not proffer any evidence demonstrating when the area at issue was last inspected prior to the plaintiff's alleged accident. Moreover, the defendants failed to make a prima facie showing that the alleged defect that caused the plaintiff to fall was not visible and apparent, and would not have been noticed upon a reasonable inspection of the area where the plaintiff alleged she tripped and fell. Next is Arnone versus Morton's of Chicago on pages 13 and 14. It's another slip and fall, this time addressing whether the defendant had to show the inapplicability of any of the Espinal exceptions. Second Department, in this slip and fall case, held defendant snow removal contractor, Con Kell, did not need to demonstrate the inapplicability of any Espinal exceptions in its motion for summary judgment, because the plaintiff did not allege that any of the exceptions applied. The court wrote, there are three situations in which a party who enters a contract to render services may be said to have assumed a duty of care and thus be potentially liable in tort to third persons. One, where the contracting party, in failing to exercise reasonable care in the performance of his duties, launches a force or instrument of harm. Two, where the plaintiff detrimentally relies on the continued performance of the contracting party's duties. And three, where the contracting party has entirely displaced the other party's duty to maintain the premises safely. Where the pleadings do not allege facts which would establish the applicability of any of the Espinal exceptions, a defendant is not required to affirmatively demonstrate that the exceptions do not apply in order to establish its prima facie entitlement to judgment as a matter of law. Here, Conkell demonstrated its prima facie entitlement to judgment as a matter of law by coming forward with evidence that the plaintiff was not a party to its snow removal contract. So a defendant's snow removal contract, against whom none of the Espinal exceptions have been alleged, need only come forward with proof that the plaintiff was not a party to the snow removal contract to be awarded summary judgment. Next is Bishop on pages 14 and 15, another slip and fall, this time dealing with the concept of a trivial defect. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held defendant's motion for summary judgment in this slip and fall case should not have been granted. Plaintiff allegedly tripped on an uneven sewer grate in a parking lot. The evidence did not demonstrate, prima facie, that the defect was trivial. Therefore, the burden of proof on the summary judgment motion never shifted to the plaintiff. The court wrote, in determining whether a defect is trivial, the court must examine all of the facts presented, including the width, depth, elevation, irregularity, and appearance of the defect, along with the time, place, and circumstances of the injury. There is no minimal dimension test or per se rule that the condition must be of a certain height or depth in order to be actionable. Physically small defects may be actionable when their surrounding circumstances or intrinsic characteristics make them difficult for a pedestrian to see or to identify as hazards, or difficult to traverse safely on foot. So again, the Supreme Court should not have granted defendant's motion for summary judgment based on a finding that the defect, the uneven sewer grate, was trivial as a matter of law. Next is Herrera versus Vargas on page 15. It's another slip and fall case This time it involves an out-of-possession landlord. It also involves the type of proof that can be submitted for the first time in opposition to a summary judgment motion. The First Department, reversing Supreme Court in this sidewalk slip and fall case, held 1. A 2019 Court of Appeals decision clarified the defendant out-of-possession landlord's duty to keep sidewalks safe, notwithstanding any maintenance agreement or arrangement with the tenant. 2. Although the plaintiff was required to allege the defendant violated the New York City Administrative Code and failed to do so, plaintiff could rely on the code provision in opposition to defendant's summary judgment motion. And 3, plaintiff raised a question of fact whether the ice condition existed before the alleged storm in progress at or near the time of the fall. The court wrote, the court's determination that defendant was entitled to summary judgment dismissing the complaint on the ground that he is an out-of-possession landlord is no longer sound in light of the Court of Appeals decision in Xiang Fu Hei versus Troon Management, 34 New York 3rd, page 167. Even if plaintiff was required to plead defendant's violation of Administrative Code of the City of New York, section 7-210, which he undisputedly failed to do, plaintiff's reliance thereon for the first time in opposition to defendant's motion for summary judgment was permissible, given that doing so did not raise any new theory of liability or prejudice. Next is Gill versus Margus Realty, which is on page 17. It's another slip and fall. First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held defendant's motion for summary judgment in this stairway slip and fall case should not have been granted. The fact that there was a handrail on the left did not warrant summary judgment because there was no handrail on the right. The court wrote, plaintiff was injured when, while descending the right side of the exterior staircase of the subject premises, she slipped, and when she tried to grab onto a handrail, there was no right-sided handrail. A triable issue of fact exists as to whether the absence of a required handrail on that side of the staircase was a proximate cause of the accident. Defendant's argument that the missing handrail on the right side of the staircase did not proximately cause plaintiff's fall, since she chose not to use the available left side handrail, is directed to the issue of comparative negligence. Again, the defendant's summary judgment motion should not have been granted in that case. At this point, I'm going to insert the verification code to be placed on your attorney affirmation for this May 2020 negligence update CLE. The verification code is dealer. Again, the verification code for this May 2020 negligence update CLE is dealer. Next is Gonzalez, which is on pages 19 and 20. It's a traffic accident case, and it deals with liability that's premised on ownership of a car that was just recently sold. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the dealer's name is Zaki, Z-A-K-I, which sold a car to the hit-and-run driver named Marcial in this pedestrian traffic accident case, demonstrated it was not the owner of the car at the time of the accident. The transaction was complete and the driver was insured. When the dealer submitted the title paperwork to the Department of Motor Vehicles, a mistake was discovered requiring that the dealer submit corrected paperwork. Therefore, technically, the dealer was not in compliance with the requirement that the title paperwork be submitted to the Department of Motor Vehicles within 5 days. That technical defect did not affect the validity of the transfer of the ownership to the driver. And finally, the last case is on page 20. It's another traffic accident case involving a bicyclist. First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held plaintiff bicyclist was entitled to summary judgment in this traffic accident case based upon the video taken from inside defendant's truck, which collided with the plaintiff on his bicycle. The court wrote, The video footage taken from inside defendant's truck shows plaintiff bicycling on the right side of the lane in front of Ortiz, the truck driver, before being struck. Ortiz therefore failed to exercise due care to avoid colliding with a bicyclist, that's Vehicle and Traffic Law Section 1146A, and breached his duty to see what should be seen and to exercise reasonable care under the circumstances to avoid an accident. Moreover, plaintiff was not required to demonstrate his own freedom from comparative negligence, nor to show that defendant's negligence was the sole proximate cause of the accident to be entitled to summary judgment. And that concludes this May 2020 Negligence Update CLE.